are in Berkeley, California, actually at the Hotel Durant on the edge of the Berkeley campus. And Lauren Frank, who heads the Frank Lab, works on Hippocampus at UC San Francisco, has kindly taken a little tour over here to visit. And so welcome, Lauren.
Thank you.
Good to see you. First of all, let's talk about some of your work, and let's go to the rather interesting story that came out recently. Was splattered all over the press. Here's the headline: UCF study involving thoughtful rats could radically alter perceptions of how brain works. There's a nice picture of Nicodemus the rat,
lovely,
and so on, telling you that you could learn a lot from a rat's brain. So why don't you just encapsulate what this is about?
All right.
It'll get us into your
Sounds
area.
Sounds good. So what we study, the things that we're interested in, is how is it that animals, ourselves, but we work in rats, form new memories? That is, how do they go about their daily lives and learn, oh, food is over there, reward is over there, I should stay away from this spot, and so on. And this is something that all of us do all the time, and we'd like to understand how is it that the brain does that. And in particular, we focus on a region called the hippocampus. This is an area that, or a part of the brain, that's absolutely essential for forming these memories of, in humans, the events of our daily life. In rats, it's particularly easy to see its importance when the animals are learning their way around places. So you can think about a space as a conjunction of a whole bunch of things, like, you know, there's a chair here, there's a sofa there, and so on. And each of these elements are things that are familiar, but what's unique, for example, about this particular place is their conjunction, the way they're all laid out. So what the hippocampus seems to let us do is store memories for these conjunctions, for these special sort of combinations of things out in the world that make each event or each episode or each place that we're in unique. And so what we're trying to do then is understand at the level of individual neurons, of, you know, different part, how different parts of the structure work, how these neurons can change in such a way that they enable the animal to go somewhere, develop some sort of memory or representation of that place, and then remember that later, call that up again when it becomes relevant to make decisions or to say, do I know where I am? Do I know where to go?
Now, this would involve things called place cells.
Place cells,
would you
absolutely.
Like to just do a quick 101 here. What does the word hippocampus mean?
All right, so the word
where does it live in the brain,
yes,
and what are place cells?
All right.
And why should we care about this?
So the hippocampus is originally derived from the word for seahorse.
Right.
And the reason is that the early anatomists looked at it and said, it looks a lot like a seahorse. And indeed, much of brain anatomy is derived from what things look like rather than what they do, which actually gives it a sort of a nice flavor from my perspective. Now, the hippocampus in humans is located sort of inside the brain about here in what's called the medial temporal lobe. So it's sort of down by your ear, and it's inside, which means there's cortex, which is the sort of skin of the brain on the outside of it, and it, you know, as I said, it's on the center part of that area. The reason we should care about it, from my perspective, is if you take it out, most of the things that we think of as our part of our normal daily life, having conversations, interacting with people, remembering where we parked the car, all of these things become basically very difficult or impossible. You can't remember things for more than a few minutes at a time without the hippocampus. You just can't store those memories. So the classic case was of a human being named HM, and he underwent surgery which removed a large part of his temporal lobe, which are these areas, the hippocampus and areas around it. And after that surgery, he could no longer form new memories. So he could meet someone, talk with them for a few minutes, they could walk out of the room, they could come back in, and he would have no idea who they were. And so from my perspective, sort of philosophically, the hippocampus is a central element to who we are. It's our ability to sort of construct a narrative around our lives and to be able to sort of make sensible internal models of how the world works and our place in it.
Okay. I had a lot of fun, actually. We went in, HM's brain ended up at UC San Diego. So I was actually in the room with Jacopo Agnese when he was actually doing the slices of HM's brain, which is an enormously historical moment.
Absolutely.
To make an atlas of what was going on at some point down the line. So
place cells. Okay, so now we know as a whole that the hippocampus is important for storing memories, and what we'd like to do is get down inside it and understand how do the individual neurons, the individual parts that make it up, allow us to do things. So in the rat, as I said, we study this in the context of places, that is, the animals finding their way around. And what was discovered originally in 1971 by John O'Keefe is that if you record from these neurons, if you put an electrode next to them in the brain of a rat as it wanders around, you find that individual neurons are active, that is, they fire, only in a small region of the animal's environment. So if the animal's wandering around a tabletop, the animal might be here and the cell would be going off, bum, 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 and the animal would walk over here and the cell would be silent. And so a different cell, on the other hand, might be active over here and silent over here. And the result of all this is if you have a large number of these cells, you have a map of the environment. You have things that say, oh, this is where I am now, and I move over here, and then you have a different set of cells active. So we think of these cells as sort of the fundamental building blocks of the animal's sense of where it is in the world. And I'll say parenthetically, the properties of these cells, that is that they're very specific for individual places, look shockingly like the properties of human hippocampal cells that people have recorded in Itzhak Fried's lab at UCLA, where they've looked at sort of how do people respond to different things, and they find individual cells that say respond only to Jennifer Aniston, only to that very specific thing, but not only to a picture of her, but also her name and so on and so forth. And so the idea is that these neurons seem to encode very complex conjunctions of stuff that only exist in one place or in sort of one conceptual space. You know, for a rat, it's a place here on the maze. For a human, it's something like Jennifer Aniston or maybe the Eiffel Tower or something
like
that.
All right, let's just pause there for a moment because Christoph Koch and Itzhak Fried, of course, doing this work. I spent some time with Horace Barlow. You can actually see a nice talk with Horace on the Science Network. Horace came up with the whole notion of grandmother cells.
Yes.
These individual cells that might instantiate very complicated pieces of information, acutely focused information, as you said, a Jennifer Aniston cell.
Yes.
Do you believe that?
So it is manifestly true that there are cells that seem to be very selective. Now, the idea of a grandmother cell also has this corollary that if somehow that cell were to die, you would no longer know that Jennifer Aniston existed. That is, that cell somehow encapsulates your complete understanding of Jennifer Aniston. That is almost certainly wrong. So there are individual cells that are very selective, but they live in a broad network of hundreds of thousands, millions of cells, and there are other cells with overlapping patterns of selectivity. So in the case of a rat hippocampus, we have a cell that might be active here, but there will be a cell somewhere else that is active a tiny bit displaced or in a slightly different place. Together, all of those cells contribute to this idea of a place. Similarly, I think it's pretty likely that in the case of the Jennifer Aniston cell, there are multiple cells, some of which are specific to Jennifer Aniston, some of which might be specific to the cast of Friends or whatever particular set of overlapping categories you have. And it's the conjunction of all those cells together that really define the concept. So that there's very specific coding, but it's still distributed across many neurons and not localized into a single neuron, which is kind of what the idea of grandmother cell suggests.
Right. So, but do you think of, and it seems to me that when people think about the impact of their research, and we're talking about a network that talks about the impact of science on social policy, that I kind of assume that you must have some sort of model of the mind in mind when you're thinking about these things. And how, in fact, would one go about setting up educational systems or anything else without having some basic fundamental idea of how minds work? What are your priors? What are your biases? I mean, are you thinking about here a highly modularized brain with lots of bits sort of talking to each other? Are you thinking of a highly networked brain?
Yes, I would say much more the latter, a highly networked brain, where you know, we always have this desire to be able to say, oh, this area does X, where it's a single function. But really what's going on in the brain all the time are patterns of activity are flowing through very complicated networks in very complicated ways. Everything is connected to everything. So different areas have different specializations. They might transform or deal with the information passing through them in particular ways. But without a downstream area to do the right thing with that, that transformation is not useful. And so, I mean, and I think really this is the challenge of much of the work, is that we have to go beyond sort of our localized understanding and think, how does everything interact with everything? How can we possibly make sense of something that's that complicated? And that's, you know, so our goal has been to try to sort of step towards that, to say, can we understand how these areas might be interacting locally, and then can we move out and ask how they might be interacting more globally?
Let's go back to Nicodemus in this story, and I'll actually just go to some of this copy to make sure that it's not been mistakenly reported. Frank and his team observed rats as they sniffed and scampered their way through the days. The scientists observed the activity in the rats' hippocampuses, brain's memory center for the sake of brevity. All right. When the creatures were either out roaming around or dozing in bed, well, rat bed. Contrary to conventional wisdom, the researchers noted that during the rats' waking hours, they were constantly replaying memories of events that took place roughly half an hour earlier. What's going on there?
All right. So let's imagine a rat, say, running on that tabletop that we'd set up earlier. This rat would run through, say, this place, and then this place, and then this place, and then this place. And what that sort of means is that the experience of running through those places creates a unique sequence of place cells that are active. First this one, then this one, and this one, and so on. So we can think of those sequences of cells as sort of the elemental part of a memory of sort of having this experience of going one from one place to the other. And so what we'd like to know is, well, how does the network store these sequences? How does the animal remember, oh, I performed this sequence yesterday, or I've been in this place, and this is how these places are related to each other? So what we found is, of course, as the animal runs around, we can see these sequences in action. But each time the animal stopped, we also saw the same sequences. That is, cell one, cell two, and so on, being coming back up in the animal's head while he was clearly awake, while he was just taking a pause, you know, from his otherwise activities. And those sequences could be from things that he'd just done. For example, he could go here, 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 and replay that sequence. Or they could be things from things he did in a different place half an hour ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so the reason that this is different than what we had thought is there had been this kind of idea that the way memory works is that the hippocampus stores these sequences. It has an experience, and it says, okay, this place is connected to this place, is connected to this place. And then later, during sleep, when all of the sensory input, all of the sort of outside world coming in is, you know, muted or turned off, then the hippocampus can re-express these sequences to try and teach the rest of the brain what it's learned. So that's a fairly common tenet of the way we think about it. The hippocampus learns quickly. The rest of the brain seems to learn a little bit more slowly. And so the hippocampus is specialized to learn things from a single presentation and then repeat them back again over and over again to the rest of the brain so the rest of the brain can eventually catch on. Now, if that only happens during sleep, then we'd say, okay, the animal has an experience. Then the animal goes to bed at the end of the day and rehashes all those experiences and puts them in a more permanent form, something called consolidation. That's how it's usually referred to. What we found is, in fact, that seems to be going on all the time while the animal is awake. So it's not just at the end of the day that the animal starts basically rehearsing, but anytime the animal, the way we think of it, gives its hippocampus a chance and sort of stops for a moment, pauses, takes a bit of downtime, then the hippocampus starts spitting out these sequences. Hey, I learned this. This is what happened before to the rest of the brain. So there's this constant interweaving of ongoing experience and then pauses in that ongoing experience, which let the hippocampus sort of pull up memories from the past and send them out to the rest of the brain.
All right, now that raises a number of points that I would like to go back to, but let me just finish this off first of all, because the way this piece was written, and this is the San Francisco Weekly, it's a blog, so one of the things that we're wrestling with is to say that although a lot of newspapers are cutting down their science departments and science writing, there's lots of stuff spreading up all over the places. The question is, how accurate are these things? So
yes.
I'm just checking, just checking as we go along.
I appreciate that.
Here's where we get to the practical implications. All right, so it says here, it quotes you, it says, elements of past experience are constantly being reactivated as we go about our daily lives independent of incoming sensory information. That's kind of what you said, that's
yep.
Fine. So here's where we get to the practical implications. If scientists can block out or play up the creation of selected memories, it could be possible to snuff out horrific recollections associated with conditions like post-traumatic stress disorder, or for that matter, which is why I mentioned this earlier, render the eternal sunshine of the spotless mind into a documentary.
Yes.
But we digress, he says at the end. So this connects with a lot of the stuff about erasure, Liz Phelps's work, Joe Ledoux, emotional states, memory, and so on. Could you lead us into that area?
Absolutely. Okay, yeah. So the idea is, and this is just an idea, right? So we need to separate what we understand from what we think might be going on.
Right.
The idea is that if this sort of rehearsal process where the hippocampus says, hey, this is what I've learned, the rest of the brain, pay attention, if that is really crucial to the memory process, and we have good reason to think it is, or to storing memories for long term, then if we can interfere or modify how that process works, then we can change which memories are stored or how strongly they're stored. So, for example, what we went on in a subsequent study to that, to show that when the animal gets a reward, it replays sort of sequences or elements of its experience associated with the reward location much, much more strongly than if it goes to the same place but doesn't get a reward. What this is suggesting to us is the context in which a memory is stored, the rewarding or perhaps even the stressful nature of the memory, is going to have a big effect on how much that memory is replayed. So it may be that the strength of different memories in our head is directly related to the context in which we experience them and how much that context says, hey, this is an important thing, you should remember that, versus, this doesn't matter so much, let's not worry about it. So from that perspective, the idea of this as a sort of in the context of PTSD is that clearly, you know, incredibly stressful memories are stored very, very strongly. And the sort of measure of this or the manifestation of this in PTSD is that these memories constantly intrude on the person's normal life. And so the question is, first of all, is that intrusion, the hippocampus reactivating these memories over and over again? And in any case, if after they're stored, or as they are being reactivated, if we could block that reactivation process, if we could block or at least temper down the amount that this memory gets pulled up over and over again, could we perhaps think of this as a way to start, you know, mitigating or, you know, minimizing the effect of this memory on daily life?
Let me actually leap from there to something that we've talked about before. The temporal dynamics of learning center at UCST, and the science network's involved in that. We have a lot of that on the homepage, on the website. We have discussions with Andrea Chiba and so on and so forth. One of the things that we've been that she has been talking to with Mooming Poo, who's up here as well, Yang Dan, is a notion that they kind of put scare quotes around, which is being addicted to learning. Now, when you were talking about PTSD, you were talking about a stressful state in that particular case, which nevertheless encodes a memory much more strongly.
Yes.
So in other words, in a kind of way, that was learnt better than anything else.
Absolutely.
Can you imagine and speak to this notion of moving beyond the normal biological homeostatic, everything being nicely modulated, working off a fixed point, the brain as a system here, to cranking it up a little bit, which would be called allostasis, to a position where it's learning better without, at the same time, damaging it so that it's stressed out. How do we get into that kind
Absolutely.
Of territory?
So I think there's multiple possibilities, and again, this is in the realm of speculation, but
right.
It's appealing speculation.
Yes.
So there's a couple of things. Let me start with sort of the most prosaic of that, which is just our experience with training rats to do things. And this is very simple and sort of obvious in retrospect, but one of our goals is to get rats to feel comfortable learning and to be in a position in a sort of psychological space, if you will, where they're happy to run around and happy to explore. The difficulty is that rats, like most animals, are a bit fearful of things that are new. So that, in fact, new experiences activate many of the same stress pathways that other stressful events do.
Right.
And so the question is, how do you put the organism in a state where the activation of those stress pathways is not enough to cause them to freeze or to stop or not to engage? And so we find that we need to be friends with our animals. We need to treat them really well. We need to take really good care of them. We need to make sure that they have sort of a reliable and predictable life.
And crank up their dopamine levels.
And crank up their dopamine, crank up their ability to sort of feel like the world is predictable and consistent.
Yeah.
And that puts them in a space where they're able to go out and learn, and to learn very quickly. And if we don't do that, they don't learn quickly. All right, so that's the simple thing. Again, that's kind of obvious because we all know that, for example, with children who feel very stressed or have difficult home situations have much more trouble learning than children who sort of feel like they have a supportive, predictable environment. All right, so that's fairly commonly understood, I think. At the second time, then, we can imagine, okay, what things could we do if we think of this memory replay process, you know, getting to something more mechanistic as a key element of this, how might we be able to turn it up when we need to? All right. Now, what we found, and this was one of the surprising results of this, is that these memory replay events were actually better. That is, they were more accurate recapitulations of past experience when the animal basically had a brief pause. So the animal would run around, take a moment of downtime, 5, 10 seconds maybe, play these things out, and then go on about its business. So it was these short pauses when the network was almost in this in-between state where the recapitulation of past experience seemed to be most accurate. And so what this suggests to us is this might be important, you know, if we're trying to push the system towards learning, we'd like to take advantage of its natural dynamics. And we'd like to take advantage of how can we structure experience or how can we structure learning in such a way that we have, you know, enough time for this kind of rehearsal process built in, enough little pauses in sort of the digestion of information that the system might be able to, you know, naturally enhance, or the system could take advantage of its natural tendency to spit these things out and to help us learn these things.
Fine. Now, let me give you for instance. If I'm in the army and I'm being sent to Afghanistan and I'm a sniper or whatever, and if I just go along with my usual brain set with its happily bubbling along homeostatic,
yes,
situation, I'll probably get shot.
probably.
I need to have everything cranked up a little
absolutely.
Bit.
Absolutely.
I need to be more alert and so on.
Right.
So this is a good thing.
Yes.
Because I'm learning faster, I'm more alert, I'm more acute and so on, reaction times are faster possibly and so on and so forth. But I can't keep on doing that, can I? Because doesn't the system eventually get stressed out and worn out?
Yeah, the system runs out of resources, yes.
So even if you can get a situation where you've lifted your fixed point, your up to this allostatic new position, how do you maintain this level of new skill
right.
without becoming a basket case?
Absolutely. So the short answer is I don't know. If I were to guess, I think that, you know, the issue is one of I think of it now as having enough downtime where you've alternated between sort of focused periods of learning and maybe focused periods of learning with small breaks, and then, you know, other periods where you're just allowed to be. And I mean, this is something we sort of talk about a lot in our current culture with people feeling overscheduled and constantly being bombarded with information. And it's not clear to me how good the research is at this point, but it seems intuitively plausible to me that that is does have sort of a long-term negative effect on us, because it doesn't give us that sort of okay, let's take a break time, which would allow you to sort of more deeply process, reset your system so that you can go back into an elevated mode.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right, so a couple of your more recent things here, a couple of papers that I'm looking at from, this is what you're talking about, this is from Neuron, rewarded outcomes enhance reactivation of experience in the hippocampus. So you're talking about the whole dopamine system, the reward system.
Yep, absolutely.
And remembering experiences that lead to reward more
yes.
effectively,
yes.
more efficiently.
Yes.
So if that can be made part of your daily routine,
right.
then you're a happier rat. And
you likely will learn much faster.
Yeah, a smarter rat.
Right.
Right.
The only thing I can add to that then is that, you know, there's one of the other issues associated with learning and sort of education is how do you make the learning itself rewarding? So, you know, in the case of the rats, what we're doing is giving them chocolate because they really like chocolate. And that turns out to be a very effective reward for the animals. A rat will, however, naturally explore on its own just because it has a drive to do so and it seems to find exploration or understanding its world somewhat rewarding. So there's this, you know, sort of a secondary question of can we modify the learning process so that it becomes an intrinsically rewarding thing for people, right? And obviously that's a goal of a lot of schooling.
Right.
It's very hard to do intentionally. People haven't, I think, figured out how to do that particularly well, but I think that's clearly something we would like to understand.
Well, something you have in press, I think, here, behavioral state and novelty continuously modulate hippocampal information processing. This is what we're talking about. So moving now from rats to, you just became the father of a second child.
Yes.
So how does this information translate into schooling? When you think about your children's education, and you think about what we've been talking about here, which is optimizing the processing device that gets you through school, gets you through life.
Yep.
The one constant in wherever you look on the globe is this 3+ pounds of wonder tissue.
Yes.
How do you optimize that, knowing what we've been talking about here, in
right.
terms of how do you make it addicted to learning?
Absolutely. So I think you know, to the extent that our research has informed that, and it's, you know, it's still a jump because we don't know that exactly the same mechanisms are there. But it's just important for me to sort of, you know, say that because I want to make it clear we could be wrong about how this applies to humans. But to the extent that we're not wrong, the first thing, which I sort of mentioned before, is we'd like to sort of say, can we structure the time of learning, the temporal dynamics, the sort of periods when you're studying and gaining new information, to have sufficient number of these moments of rest so that you can have this kind of constant back and forth information encoding, information consolidation, the hippocampus learning things, the hippocampus sending those out to the rest of the brain to organize them, to have them sort of, you know, be incorporated into longer term stores. So I think, you know, this is also related to a very common idea that people talk about massed versus spaced training. And there's a long literature that says, if you try and train an animal to do something and you just train with no breaks, it doesn't learn very quickly. But if you do that spaced, so you train it and then you give it a break, and then you train it and you give it a break, it actually learns much more quickly, so with much less training. So I think there, this issue of you know, that time and spacing. The other thing, and the work you refer to, it's something we're currently discussing with reviewers, I guess I would say. So we're not in press yet, but we hope to be in the not too distant future, is a suggestion that the way animals move actually sort of regulates whether they're in sort of a more taking information mode or a more consolidating, sending that information out mode, and that there's actually a smooth transition. So in the case of a rat sort of gets to know its world by moving around through it. In the case of a person, we sort of get to know our world by moving around through it, but also by looking at it, by sort of exploring it personally and visually and physically and so on and so forth. And it looks like at least rat brains, and we're thinking probably human brains, are set up to change the way they encode information depending on sort of that movement. So the more the animals move, the more they seem to suppress their internal memory-driven processing and more they seem to engage things that we would think of as taking in new information. So, you know, if they're sort of looking around, it looks like that really helps them take in information. When they stopped and then held still for a little while, that sort of moves them back to this consolidation mode. And so one of the things I'm noticing with my own kids, to sort of bring this back to human beings, is my elder son, when he learns something, he gets it and then he likes to run around afterwards. And so he has this sort of alternation between being willing to sit still and engage the information and then wanting to move his body and sort of, you know, just enjoy himself for a bit. I mean, I'm not quite sure what's going on in his brain. But I think, you know, one of the things that's challenging about a normal classroom setting is the fact that you can't have kids constantly screaming and running around. And yet, particularly little boys, this seems to be something they have a naturally very strong tendency to do. And this also sort of relates to the fact that many programs now are getting rid of physical education and these sort of physical outlets. But I think that movement is actually such a big part of our information processing, you know, and you can imagine that for lots of evolutionary reasons. That is, when we were hunter-gatherers, we were out exploring the savanna, looking for new sources of food and so on. That becomes an essential part of our sort of information nature. And it may be very difficult to sort of squeeze that into a classroom setting where people have to sit still, and particularly for some children who might be sort of more on one extreme, on sort of a movement hyperactive extreme, not being able to kind of move around and express themselves and sort of alternate between modes might make it much more difficult for them to learn. So I think, you know, what we're sort of seeing is that it would be nice to be able to have a system where you could have more exploratory learning, more movement, more kind of, you know, engaging with things in an active personal way, and yet also, you know, more periods where you can just take a moment of silence, just a moment of quiet to kind of allow that sort of information to be rehearsed.
Well, you're right. I mean, that's the antithesis of what normally people expect. Sit down, be quiet, pay attention.
Right.
But if it turns out that paying attention or acquiring information is deeply connected, as you said, with feeding your hippocampus.
Absolutely, and being engaged. People can be engaged while they sit still. Clearly, right? We're all able to sort of have a very focused conversation. But, you know, I notice for myself when I'm writing or when I'm working on something hard, I often just get up and I pace around.
Right.
And I use that, and that sort of lubricates my thinking processes. And I just think we shouldn't underestimate the potential importance of that kind of, you know, mind-body interaction, of how much of our ability of our, you know, physical selves changing the way that our brains function in a sort of adaptive way.
Yeah, you made the point as well about the one of the budget cuts that happens, a couple of the budget cuts that happen in schools, forget the physical education, forget the music. These are both things from our understanding, my understanding, the TDLC research and so on, that are actually enormously helpful.
I think there's no question about it that they are a net plus. But to be fair, they may not be the fastest way to higher test scores, right? And so if one's goal is to maximize test scores in the context of, say, national testing curriculum, it may be that teaching to the test is a more effective way to do that. But it is almost certainly the case that if you want to produce independent thinkers and really thoughtful, creative people, that sort of teaching to the test without physical education, without music, without sort of alternate avenues for people to get engaged in things is not going to help. So I think, you know, this is one of the challenges that we have, is there's this problem of assessment where we'd like to make sure everyone is doing well. And then if we are assessing, we're pushing people towards doing well on the assessment, and we're pushing them away from these other things that will help them do well, but in sort of a somewhat more a broader way that might be not, you know, less specific to the test in question.
All right, suppose you were Arnie Duncan for a week and so on, and you're worried about the state of the nation's education. What do you do?
Short answer, again, I don't know. It's an incredibly difficult problem. I think, you know, it's not an issue of money. We spend more per pupil, as I understand it, than many other countries with sort of better performing educational systems. And I also think, you know, it's important to remember that the best students from this country are utterly outstanding, and they go on to be incredible innovators and so on and so forth. So where we really have a problem is not at the top, but is in the middle and at the low ends, right? And that's, you know, that's where I think the programs need to focus, you know, as you say, focus on the things that we do understand about this. The difficulty is, I think there's so much, for example, also clear evidence that things like family and family home stability and parental involvement are among the largest predictors of child success. Mm-hmm. And so if you can set up ways to bring parents in, to bring the community in, to have it be sort of a social operation rather than teach this kid when they're in school and then they're off on their own, those are the things for me that I think are most likely to help, you know, that and perhaps some restructuring to allow this kind of, you know, information flow variability, movement, non-movement kinds of things. But it's an incredibly hard problem, and I certainly don't know how to solve it.
We also talked to sleep researchers whose primary function is looking. And there again, that overlaps with the educational system because you've got a lot of tired kids out there who come in at 7 a.m., whatever it is.
And absolutely. And, you know, it's incredibly ironic. Please go ahead.
No, I was going to say, your work also kind of overlaps and speaks to that in some way.
It does. I think, you know, the one thing that we found, which was a surprise to us just on the sort of result end, was that when we looked at these, so the classic picture, sorry, let me step back for a moment. The classic picture of you learn when you are awake, you sort of store and consolidate those memories when you're asleep. When we looked at the replay of memories during more sleep-like states, they were sort of, the memories were themselves were kind of lower quality. They looked less like the actual experience, and they looked a little bit fuzzier, like other things were going on. And so one thing this led us to speculate wildly about, and this is a wild speculation that in fact the reviewers made us take out of the paper because they thought it was too wild, is that sleep might be less important for storing veridical, accurate pictures of what we've got, and more important for making connections between things that we didn't experience during our daily life. So one of the most interesting stories is, you know, of Kekulé, who sort of intuited the structure of the benzene
ring.
Molecule. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, one interesting possibility is our brains may need this time to sleep to kind of make associations between things that didn't happen together, sort of wander off in new directions, or in creative directions to think about possibilities that we didn't experience during our day. you know, it's very likely that sleep is still very important in the memory storage process as well. And there's some direct evidence for that now. But you know, what we're sort of thinking then is probably this memory storage process starts immediately after each new experience you have. And then it continues through the waking periods and through the sleep periods. Anytime the system is given a chance, it sort of goes into this storage mode. So if you have children who are in a state, you know, where they're chronically sleep deprived, where they're sort of overscheduled, you can imagine cases where they're just not giving their system enough time to really digest the ongoing information. They're too busy. And then, you know, that's really impacting their ability to store and really, really sort of get a hold of the information they're supposed to learn.
Couple of things there. One, when you were, you were talking about the, when we looked at the memories, some of them didn't look as good as,
What I mean is when we looked at the individual replay events and what these are.
What are you looking at?
Okay, so in the rat hippocampus, when the animal is still, we get these things called sharp wave ripples. The name is not terribly important, but what's going on during these events is that we have a large number of hippocampal cells all firing together in a very specific sequence, often, in the period of 1 to 200 milliseconds. So a fifth to a tenth of a second, very short. This sequence of cell activity is often the same, as I mentioned before, as the sequence of places the animal goes through. But now, instead of something that where it might say take the animal 30 seconds to wander across the tabletop, this sequence plays out in a tenth of a second, or you know, a fifth of a second, very, very quickly. And so the thought is what the brain has done is it's compressed these memories, or compressed the representation, or it's able to express these memories in a very compressed form that sort of spits out this entire sequence of, hey, all this goes together to the rest of the brain. And so what we are looking at are these compressed sequences, which we think may be sort of the little individual elements of actual memories that get sent out to the rest of the brain. And so we can identify those by a pattern of neural activity that we see, and then we can look at their content by asking, if this was the animal doing something, what would it be doing? So we can sort of read the memories. And I'll say, you know, that we are not the first people to do this. Other people sort of discovered these replay events. What we did is show that they're happening while the animal's awake and representing remote experiences from sort of the relatively distant past.
So, I mean, from this sort of not entirely an outsider at all, but it's not your primary interest, but I mean, do you have any comments about what you think about the current theories of why we sleep, what sleep is for?
Yeah, it's very, I mean, I think, so there are, as I said, there are some very recent results from the last year or two that say that if you interrupt these replay events, these memory events during sleep after a behavior, animals don't learn as quickly. So it looks like you can interfere with the learning process by interrupting these events. Now that said, the animals that didn't learn as quickly still learned. They just didn't learn as quickly. So it's not quite clear how essential it is, you know, whether if the animal, you know, given more time or given more awake time after the experience, where the animals would have been just as good. You know, my own experience, I have a very strong memory from when I was a graduate student, and I was in a computational neuroscience class with someone named Peter Diane, who is a computational, very talented, very mathematically talented.
That's the Gatsby unit at the Gatsby. UCLA.
And Peter is brilliant, and he spoke extraordinarily quickly. He speaks a little more slowly now. I think that's after having children. I think that you know, slowed him down a little bit. And I found myself in that class, and this is very unlike me, nodding off for a minute or two at a time. And what I felt like, I had this sort of personal feeling of my brain was full and the information was just too dense and I wasn't able to process anymore. So I would go out of it for a little while, I'd come back, and then I could sort of follow the information again. It was just too hot, too fast, and too much of it for me to really digest. And one of my colleagues at Caltech, someone named Thanos Siapas, published this model a little while ago, which suggested that, and this idea has been around in a bit, that you know, one function of sleep might not be just to store new memories, but also to erase some of the stuff that you already have in the hippocampus so that you can make new room for new things. And I find that very appealing as an idea, that you might want, if you have a network that's been loaded up with information, eventually it's going to reach some capacity limit where it can't store anything else. And so you might want to have a state that lets you sort of clear out the cobwebs, you know, take the stuff that you need to know, try and send it out to other areas so that they can process it and sort of, you know, clean out your sort of your slate where you write everything down on so that you can move on to process new information.
This brings to mind, of course, Crick and Mitchison's, Francis Crick and Graham Mitchison's notion of the kind of the night cleaning shift coming through.
And yes. And I think that's appealing. And given...
And the Tononi version is Chiara Chiarelli? Is there a version in there as well?
I think so. I mean, you know, I don't have a strong opinion. They're lovely theories. And, you know, it's very hard to get very strong data for any of these at this point. So I don't have strong opinions on which might be right. I mean, the one thing, you know, that is clear to me is, you know, human sleep is extremely complicated. There are many different stages of sleep. We alternate between slow wave and REM sleep. And there's a lot of machinery set up to make all of this happen. So it must be doing something really important. The other thing I'll say is I think there is, you know, when people talk about sleep and our memories for the events of our lives, there's, again, this common belief that sleep really helps us store those memories. Sleep also has been associated with storage of memories of other kinds of memories. For example, memories for how to do something, like how to play a piano. If we talk about the motor memories, like I want to, you know, tapping out a particular sequence, it seems to me completely clear that sleep helps you learn there. And what I mean by that is they look at people's performance before they sleep, and then the people sleep, and they actually get better during sleep, so that by the time they start up again after sleep, they're better than they were when they stopped. And that's pretty remarkable, that the network can sort of rearrange itself while you're sleeping to get better at a motor task. But as I understand it, for sort of the memories of our events, our declarative memories, the ones that we talk about, you know, what did you have for breakfast, right, you know, when did Napoleon invade Russia, things like that, those things generally don't get better over time. They tend to get worse and get consistently worse. And so the usual story is that sleep makes them get worse less quickly, so that sleep somehow, you know, sort of slows down the forgetting curve a little bit. And so that, I think that that's a very different thing. To slow down the forgetting curve is a very different thing than then to make things remembered much better. And, you know, and so that brings up these questions of, well, if you could put the animal, a person, say, in a sensory deprivation chamber where they weren't asleep, but they didn't have to process any information, would that be the same as sleep? And is it that sleep is really helping the memories directly, or is what it's doing preventing new things that would come in when you're awake from disrupting them?
Like that.
Like that, for example.
Disrupting.
Yes,
you.
Absolutely. What were we talking about?
I don't know, but I'll remember it forever.
Exactly.
Curiously enough, there's Billy Collins was the poet laureate of the United States, still writing wonderful poetry. He has a poem called Forgetfulness. It's just that you meant the way you were describing this. Let me just read you two verses.
Sure.
It'll give you the name of the author is the first to go, followed obediently by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion, the entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you've never read, never ever heard of. As if, one by one, the memories you used to harbor decided to retire to the southern hemisphere of the brain, to a little fishing village where there are no phones.
That's lovely.
So, long ago, you kissed the names of the nine muses goodbye and watched the quadratic equation pack its bag, and even now, as you memorize the order of the planets, something else is slipping away. A state flower, perhaps, the address of an uncle, the capital of Paraguay. And it goes on. But that's a wonderful,
absolutely,
to me, a great piece of poetry, which makes you instantly get some of the stuff that you were talking about there.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, there's this open question, do we actually forget things, or do we just forget how to get to them? And it's not clear. You know, it seems likely, because there are a finite number of synapses in the brain, there are a finite number of brain pathways.
Yes, well, I was going to say, the state flower of the capital of Paraguay, the address of an uncle, as you're saying, maybe it's not actually gone. Maybe if you dug around somewhere else and hit some other part of a network that had been instantiated and stored a lot of that information about Paraguay, you'd then recapture the capital.
It's very possible. And, you know, we know in general, even if you've forgotten something, it's much easier to learn again than it is to learn the first time. And so that suggests that at least some of those pathways that you use, some of the patterns of activity or the patterns of synaptic change, are still there, and they're still helping you along. They're just not sort of consciously accessible in the way that you would want them to be. And so that seems very likely to me. It's probably some mixture of both. You lose a little, but mostly probably you lose access. And it kind of makes sense that our brains are constantly changing, they're constantly rewiring themselves bit by bit, and so you can store a memory and then you can wander away from the sort of patterns that allowed you to get back to that memory. And so unless you bring that memory back over and over again and sort of help rewrite it in the circuitry and reestablish it with your new sort of brain architecture, it's easy for things to get lost.
Yeah. Neuroplasticity, of course, which is neuroscience has been working on this for a long time. It's suddenly been discovered by a larger public, and you can change your mind and so on and so forth. Ups and downs of that. This is the current issue of Prospect magazine. And there's a review in here of a new book by Nicholas Carr called The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains. And the headline of this review sort of gives it away, Losing Our Minds to the Web, Damaging Teenagers' Brains, Ability to Think, da-da-da-da-da. Talks about the beginnings of neuroplasticity, goes back to Eric Kandel. But mentions here, he says, Carr mentions an oft-cited study that found changes in the brain structures of London cab drivers as they began relying on GPS, global positioning systems, rather than their memories to navigate. We've talked about this before. I did, in The Human Quest, a piece about the knowledge, which is this information London cabbies have to get, memorizing these thousands and thousands of points, as they're called, hotels and museums and so on. And if you don't remember these things and pass a test when you're given a drive from here to there, you know, you don't get to be a cabbie. It's called the knowledge. And later on, Eleanor Maguire did some nice work on looking at this and the impacts on hippocampus and whether cab drivers have better developed hippocampi than others and so on and so forth. This latest stuff, which showing that they're not, if you don't use it, you lose it sort of thing. I mean, would you like to comment on this?
Yeah, I mean, that seems very likely to me. You know, it's clear that if information is available to you instantly, you lose the ability to sort of store it yourself because you don't need to. There's no impetus to store it yourself. I mean, I think, you know, we can see this historically, right? That people, there used to be people who would train themselves, you know, bards, for example, to train themselves to be able to sing all of the songs and, you know, to have remember all of the oral histories of their tribe and things like that. And that sort of thing largely isn't an issue anymore. It isn't necessary because we have digital and non-digital forms of record keeping. So people don't have to train themselves to be sort of that able. It seems to me that indeed the fact that we don't need to learn these things anymore means that we're not storing them. And, you know, that's a double-edged sword. On one hand, it might mean that we could put our attention towards synthesizing information in new ways. Mm-hmm. You know, my wife, for example, she's an avid user of the web. She uses it to get specific bits of information from 15 different sources and synthesize them into some idea of, you know, depending on whatever she's interested in. From my perspective, that couldn't have been done without hours in the library, you know, 20 years ago.
Right.
And so that's a real advantage. But if all you're doing is looking things up and then not going anywhere with that information or not trying to actually build some sort of intellectual edifice, then basically you have sort of a lowest common denominator outcome and you lose the ability. You know, to the extent that the internet doesn't go down, it's not totally clear to me how that's going to damage us. But if it ever does go down, people are going to be in a lot of trouble because they won't know how to do any of the things that they'd like to be able to do.
I'm just curious, how did you actually get into this whole area? I mean, yeah. Did you have geeky parents? Did you always want to be a scientist?
I wanted to be. Actually, it's a story of how you can't get away from your roots. Actually, so my father was a psychiatrist. My mother, she has a PhD in sort of family relations, things like that. But her master's was in Russian studies, so she sort of was all over the place. And you know, I had a very psychological household growing up, so we would constantly discuss things, and perhaps in reaction to this, from age 5 to age 17, I was dead set on becoming a physicist. Okay. And I loved physics, and I still very much like physics, but as I went to college, and actually in classical mechanics, my freshman year of college, I recognized that I didn't care enough to do physics, that it just wasn't exciting to me the way it should have been, and that damp-driven harmonic motion was something that whose equations I could solve, but I didn't really want to anymore. And I also realized that the thing about physics that I found most intriguing were the quantum effects, the idea that there's an observer, and the observer causes the state of the system to collapse into one of various outcomes. But if you're not looking at it, the world is sort of a set of probability distributions, and that looking at things fundamentally changes the way the world works. And that sort of was my entree into the idea of, oh gosh, we're understanding pretty well the basic physics of things. We have absolutely no idea about how this looking at process works. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I recognize quite firmly at this point that I was not a super genius, or really a genius at all, and that to make really fundamental progress in physics these days, it seemed to me you pretty much had to be, and I wasn't. And so that combination of things sort of shoved me back. I ended up as a psychology major, which I try not to admit to my colleagues very often because they laugh at me. But we're okay with it. They've come to terms with it. And then I sort of wandered back towards neuroscience as I could, sort of feeling like that was the place, that was the place that was the intersection between, you know, my desire to do things reasonably mechanistically, and I've always been sort of a programmer and things at heart, and my, you know, desire to sort of get at what's the underlying mechanism, but also able to address what I consider to be philosophically satisfying questions about, you know, who are we and what makes us up, and how do we take our lives and turn them into some sort of meaningful experience and use our memories to guide our decisions and all these sorts of things, which I feel like we can actually study.
So is the sort of the next intellectual bus stop back on the journey to physics? I mean, it was sort of...
A bit, yes. But, you know, I find myself now interacting with groups who are thinking about the hippocampus and its role in schizophrenia. And, you know, my father saw schizophrenic patients. So it's actually quite disturbing in a way to see at some level I am trying to go more mechanistic, but I'm also now engaging issues which are much more like the ones that I was exposed to as a child, which I just didn't expect to happen. But there you are.
Yeah. Okay. So major impacts in the development. I mean, Matthew Wilson's name comes up quite a bit. Matt Wilson doing still writing some great papers on memory replay and so on.
Absolutely. Oh, sorry. So what's the...
The role... I'm trying to give people some sense of how important... In the trajectory as you're becoming a scientist...
The people, yes. The people are absolutely critical.
The mentoring.
Yes. I cannot overstate how essential that was. And for me, it started... I went to a small liberal arts school as an undergraduate, Carleton College, which was great for me in a lot of ways. I got a lot of close experience or close interaction with my faculty mentors. And one of them helped me get a summer job. So I sent out applications to a bunch of places, which included Bruce McNaughton and Carol Barnes's lab in Arizona. And they were willing to hire me. And so I went there for a summer and I worked there working on a model of part of the hippocampus, and they were willing to have me back over the winter. So I sensibly, I thought, spent my winter in Tucson rather than in Northfield, Minnesota for my senior year. And that was actually where I met Matt Wilson. And so, you know, that sort of experience, that happenstance that Bruce was willing to hire me to do some modeling and I happened to meet Matt there, had a huge impact on everything that I did subsequently. And I ended up going to graduate school working with Matt, you know, and that was definitely a formative experience. It was sort of something where I learned a huge amount of what I now know and sort of really shaped my interactions and like how I run my lab and things like that.
Yeah. Do you think that you will be able to at some point, I mean, now knowing what you do, I mean, what would be the advice you'd give to a young scientist, somebody just starting?
So a couple of things. Finding a good senior mentor, someone who can help you understand the rules of the game and, you know, how to succeed, like what's important, how to choose people for your lab, how to interact with your fellows, how, you know, things like that, how to write grants. Those are absolutely crucial. I think the other thing is, I mean, I guess it depends on which stage of science. I end up having a number of applicants, people who want to work in my lab, and one thing I notice is that there tends to be sort of two camps of people. There's the sort of mathematically oriented people and the more psychologically oriented people. And so one thing I'm trying hard to do is get these camps to merge a bit. One thing that, for example, is, you know, math and computers and understanding complicated patterns of activity is absolutely essential from my perspective, to understanding the brain. And a lot of the people with psychological backgrounds are less comfortable with that. And a lot of the people with the mathematical backgrounds don't have any introduction to the psychological or biological issues. So, you know, one thing I encourage people to do is take the biology, but also take as much math and computer science as you can, so that you really have a broad background in the tools that you need to be able to sort of look at these systems from different perspectives.
How do you see this particular field developing? I mean, one of the important sections that you have in the little description of your lab on your website is the section that we've talked about somewhat. Reward enhances replay of recent experience. Rewarding environments just seems to be kind of obvious, but
yes.
How many people actually inhabit rewarding environments?
Sadly, few.
Yeah.
I mean, it's shockingly difficult, right? Particularly in, you know, in this country now with the current economic situation and so on, the levels of stress are overwhelming for many, many people. And so getting someone in a state where they can sort of feel comfortable and happy and enjoy learning about things is really, really difficult. You know, it's not clear to me how to solve that problem. I mean, the one thing that comes to mind is just, you know, it's a question of priorities, right? Is like what actually do we want our lives to be like? What things are most important? How do we reset our set of expectations so that things that we have access to are actually rewarding as opposed to things we don't?
Yeah, I was thinking about the classroom setting as well. I mean, this is a recent cover of Science magazine for 23 April 2010. Take a look at that. All right, so that was shot in 1948.
Mm-hmm.
And those little kids are
doing some fun
obviously
chemistry.
Very attentive.
Yes.
And they're actually reading nuclear physics. and they're 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So the world has changed.
Yes.
The classes are bigger, whatever. There's so much more going on. That it's a more complicated society. So the difficulty, it seems, for the education system and then drilling down to individual teachers in classrooms to provide this rewarding environment where the kind of research you're talking about, which they would love to know about more, I think, would help them possibly redesign the environment of the classroom.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, So at some level then, this is sort of, we talked about this a bit ago, but, you know, there's the necessity of having the experience be rewarding and fulfilling. That is, having the sense of intellectual mastery over something provide some sort of reward. There's also, of course, the, you know, various places that have been paying children for A's. Right, which is the other way, and that also makes it rewarding. The thing that people can get concerned about, of course, is that it's an extrinsic rather than an intrinsic.
It was a cover of Time magazine recently. Should we pay kids?
Yeah,
doing well?
Absolutely. And you know, it's not clear to me, but I think I'm actually wondering about the experiment of paying kids or having it be actively rewarding. You know, one thing that we find, for example, with rats is they will initially run for reward, but once they get the idea, they'll just run. And they seem to enjoy the experience. And once they've built up rewarding associations, in some cases you can get them to continue to behave for at least a reasonable time without the reward. It's at the same time, you can also get them into states where the reward is absolutely essential for their behavior and they won't do anything without it. And so it's that sort of balance, right? Of how do you, because you know, for us, for our children, for example, my children, we spend a moderate amount of time trying to encourage them and sort of give them explicit feedback on things that they're doing that we like, because we feel like that's a really helpful way to get them to do it. On the other hand, we'd also like to respect the fact that they are their own organisms, and what's most important is that they develop an intrinsic sense. And I don't know how to do that.
I mentioned this kids being rewarded story to Esther Wojcicki, who runs a Palo Alto high school. There's a conversation with her on the Science Network, and she's an extraordinarily successful teacher. This class has grown by leaps and bounds. We filmed in there, and they run the classroom pretty much themselves. You can hardly see Esther in the movie when you see the class, and they're doing things like creating newspapers and so on. She uses journalism as a major inspiring tool,
right?
when I mentioned this story to her, she said, well, I don't like that. I think what happens is that the reward is in the empowerment that my class gets from doing what they're doing.
Right, the intrinsic reward. And so it seems clear to me that if you can run a classroom like that, I mean, in Palo Alto, right? I mean, I think the difficulty becomes that with resources, with very well-educated teachers and children who are motivated, that sort of classroom, from my perspective, is optimal in the external world.
Now do it in the Bronx. Or,
I don't know how to translate that, you know, and I don't pretend to even really have a good sense for the difficulties that teachers in inner cities and so on face, because it's just extreme. Just being able to control the classroom, much less be able to educate. But, you know, from that perspective, it is clearly true that the sense of autonomy or the sense of the ability to run one's own life is intrinsically rewarding. That is, you know, if you can make decisions and change your world as a function of those decisions in a better way, that clearly is a rewarding thing. And so to the extent that we could push things in that direction, that sounds fantastic. I just don't know how to do it.
Scientific American Mind, this is the July-August issue. Special report, The Sparks of Memory, How Brain Cell Links Create Our Past and Our Future, so on and so forth. Making connections, decision making.
Absolutely. So, and this is something that we also think might be related, that, you know, one of the things, the purpose of a memory at some point in a very sort of simple evolutionary perspective is to be able to know what happens if you go to a place or have an experience so that you can repeat it if it's valuable or not, or learn from it in some way to increase your fitness as an organism, which means that you need to be able to retrieve these memories when it's relevant to be able to sort of make intelligent decisions. And one thing that we're finding now, this is sort of in the very early stages, but we're pretty confident of it now, is that the amount of this kind of memory replay, the thing that I've been talking about in the context of forming memories, also tells us how well, whether an animal is about to make the right choice or not. So what we think is that there's this sort of common mechanism where things that happened in the past get brought up again. And this allows the system both to store memories for what happens, but also to evaluate the possibilities. So if an animal is in a place, it can reactivate a sequence that goes out, say, this way, or another sequence that goes out this way, and say, and then send that sequence out to other parts of the brain that can say, well, the sequence this way is likely to lead to reward. The sequence this way is not. So what you should do is go this way. And so we think that there's probably a sort of a very common underlying mechanism, this sort of our ability to retrieve memories and make decisions, and our ability to store them. And what's interesting to me about that is that it suggests that that same sort of moment of downtime, that moment of thoughtful decision making, may be really important for our ability to sort of do sensible things, as well as our ability to store memories. So again, this kind of alternation between encoding information, taking a moment to process it, and then think about it, use it to guide a future decision. Those pauses may be extremely important for being sensible and being thoughtful about sort of how we go about our daily lives.
This piece in the same issue, this piece called Yearning for Yesterday, dwell on the past, it's good for you. It's talking about sort of trying to recreate, I mean, plainly each time you go through the enterprise of reclaiming a memory, you'd slightly change it in some way or
another.
Which is one of the great puzzles. How can you actually have what you think of veridical memories of events that happened?
Right. We don't, right? is a short
right.
answer.
So we're living in this continuously manufactured past.
It's very true. I mean, you know, usually, presumably, it bears some relationship. But, you know, like Elizabeth Loftus, who I'm sure you're familiar with, has done these lovely studies of eyewitness testimony and how you can cause people to completely alter their memories for things just by asking them the right sort of leading questions. And, you know, you can sort of see this from that perspective. If you have an experience, that experience is incredibly rich. It has all of these things around it. There's just too much information there for us to store all of that immediately. So instead, what we do is store traces of it. Oh, the couch was over there, and I think it was blue. And we have preset mental images for what a blue couch might look like. And so when someone were to ask me later, oh, what did the couch look like? I might be able to say it's blue. I certainly won't be able to describe it very accurately. And if I do describe something, it will probably be some other blue couch or some manufactured blue couch that I've never actually seen. And so I think this is, you know, it sort of makes sense. It's what allows us to store memories rapidly in the first place, is that instead of taking all the details, we take little hooks from things that we already know and use that together. And I guess that's the other thing that is sort of relevant perhaps from a learning perspective is that when we think about learning, learning is never done from a blank situation, at least, you know, except maybe in the extremely young infant. And even there, of course, there's lots of built-in routines. Right. Learning is about often adding new information to a conceptual structure that already exists. And the more hooks there are, the more things that you can bring in to sort of help you and guide the structure of your experience, the easier it is to learn new things. So I am able to sort of, you know, process papers or read new work in my field much more quickly than a new graduate student in my lab because I have the background to sort of assimilate all of that information. That perhaps, you know, comes back to this issue you mentioned about the internet. And the one problem may be that if you're not actively in the process or not actively storing lots of new information, if you're not really trying to incorporate that into your own schema, but instead just taking it off the web and then not paying attention to it, then you may not have the ability to sort of process other things nearly as deeply because you haven't built up that background of information. And you know, one thing that's interesting from my perspective is that there has been a push in many ways against, away from memorization and away from knowledge bases and, you know, towards something else. I'm not quite sure what the something else is. And I wonder about that a bit because I think, you know, that information is really important. Knowing what happened when, at least to a first approximation, helps you think about how things react together when you don't have immediate access to all of that information.
Yeah, I mean, it's just another example of how crucially important the neuroscience research is and how it can be introduced into all of these everyday situations. We wouldn't have been able to talk about a lot of these things had not new technologies evolved, obviously. MRI, CAT scans, and so on and so forth, investigative technologies. I noticed, incidentally, that you collaborate with Carl Dieseroth.
Yes.
This is another new technology,
yes,
the optogenetics. I hope at some point we'll have a chance to chat with him. But I mean, how does he work with you in this? I mean,
so yeah, Carl has been an incredibly generous sort of giver of technology. And so what he's done is develop these new molecules that are light sensitive, and they can change the way neurons are active if you shine light on the neurons. This is something basically only the neurons in our retina, the ones that we actually see with, had this capability before. But with the addition of viruses or genetic techniques, we can now insert these special channels into neurons and we can shine lights on them and we can now control them. And so this is potentially, I think it will be revolutionary. It's still in the early stages. But you know, one of the issues with all of our work is that we've been looking at patterns of activity and how they relate to learning. But making that causal connection, if you really want to know for absolutely certain that this pattern of activity, that say this memory replay, is critical for learning, you need to be able to perturb it. You need to be able to change it, to modify it somehow, and then show that that has some impact on the organism or on the network. And what these optogenetic tools are letting us start to do is do that perturbation in an incredibly finely selective way so that we can pick out particular types of neurons we want to change. And we can do it at very particular times with millisecond level timing resolution. And so we can start interacting with the brain on its own time scale in a very specific way. And so it really means we can really, you know, really start to pull apart the circuits and dissect what's going on where and then how patterns from one area affect patterns from another in a way that just wasn't possible 5 or 10 years ago.
In rodents?
In rodents. People are also doing it in primates. You know, it works, as far as we can tell, in basically every species that it can be tried, and just, you know, things have to be done slightly differently.
Yeah. Let me ask you a larger question about the wonders of all of this. When his administration took over, President Obama said that he would restore science to its rightful place. Where is that?
Well, I would like to think it is a place where, you know, scientific insights actually get used, that scientific results that most scientists are sure about, things like, you know, evolution and global warming, are sort of taken to be very likely to be true. I would like to think that it's a place where the society would recognize what science has done and the value of continuing to support the institution. I think, you know, our success as a country over the last 50, 100 years, I think has come in fairly large part because of our willingness to support things like basic research and applied research and really trying to push the boundaries of knowledge. I mean, this country has developed many of the new technologies that are now out there. And, you know, my main concern is that people who are sort of anti-science or less science, they want our country to do well, but they don't seem to understand that the scientific process and investigation and discovery and insight, training people how to do that, supporting the institution is absolutely essential, from my perspective, to maintaining our welfare and sort of our status, you know, the status of the Western world and so on. So I would like to think, or I do think that, you know, science deserves sort of a central place in our decision-making processes where it's relevant, and it's something that, you know, pays for itself when you support it.
Had you ever considered doing anything else? I mean, you obviously was, the science goes way back for you, but is there some unfulfilled fantasy somewhere?
Short answer is not really. I had a fairly miserable couple of years as a graduate student where I thought about quitting and becoming a computer programmer because I was completely unable to get my experiments to work. But I love trying to learn about the world. It is the thing that I feel gives me this sense of mastery, gives me this reward. I also really enjoy the people I have the opportunity to interact with. So the people in my lab, my colleagues, I have the fortune of working with really, really wonderful, smart, intellectual people whose motivations are to learn things. And that's incredibly rare. And I think, you know, historically speaking, being able to be a scientist at all is rare. You know, once upon a time, you had to be rich, independently wealthy, basically, or you had to be willing to be the apprentice to someone who was independently wealthy for 20 years. And so, for me, this is a perfect fit. I'm kind of surprised about that, and there are times when I get tired of it, but I can't think of anything else I'd rather do.
All right. One of the questions I like to ask people is, I'm going to give you a little token for time travel here, and you can bring to your dinner table anybody you wish from this history. Anybody you'd like to ask some questions of, have a conversation with?
Yes, there are a number of people I would like to ask questions of. I think I can imagine that, you know, one of them would be Archimedes. Just because he was a completely brilliant scientist who was really just interested in all sorts of inventions, in figuring out how things work and causing them to work, and is a very thoughtful guy. Without sort of a strong philosophical bent. He was a real sort of one of the very earliest empiricists from my perspective, because he wanted things that work, you know, in contrast to people like Aristotle, who was completely brilliant, clearly, but also didn't really worry about whether things actually match the outside world so long as they seemed to match in his head. So Archimedes would definitely be one of the people.
Apocryphally, of course, he would have to grab a towel if he was in
He
his,
would have to grab a towel. Well, his, you know, it's California, right? You know, from our perspective, we're not too fussed about it. We have two little boys running around naked in our house sometimes. You know, we could get him early enough that it wouldn't be too bad.
Anybody for more recent times, like the Enlightenment?
Yeah, well, so I mean...
Or Einstein, you're a physicist.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, Einstein, you know, I feel like the reason that I wouldn't jump immediately to Einstein, for example, is because his life was fairly well known.
Yeah.
You know, I think what would be really interesting, you know, as far as the Enlightenment goes, I think... Yeah, I mean, there's a tremendous number of people. Hooke, for example, who would be amazing to interact with. I think, you know, from that time, I can also imagine that that speaking with one of the philosophers, Kant or John Stuart Mill, one of those people who just sort of really came up with completely new philosophical approaches, whether or not I particularly happen to agree with them now, would be tremendously interesting. Someone who's really creative about that. Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, I guess the one other person who I can imagine who I think would have been a lot of fun to interact with was Richard Feynman. Now, he was much more recent, but he seemed to have sort of both a joy at understanding the nature of the world and just sort of an unimaginable intuition for how things work. He has these lovely sort of autobiographical books, and James Gleick, I believe, wrote a biography of him. And one of the comments in that was that he had the sort of genius that you just can't understand. There were people in the physics community who others could understand their genius as just being more of what smart people could do. But people like Feynman had a genius that was just from a completely different direction. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that sort of genius exists in biology in quite the same way. I can't really identify geniuses in my own field. I can identify a lot of very smart people. But that sort of depth of insight, maybe it's just too new. I just don't think we're quite there yet.
Interesting. So you mean in the sense that the biology stuff is very much more about tangible?
It is. It's experiments that can be done. It's ideas. It's very careful sort of experimental, you know, investigations of things. And there are obviously lots of very talented theorists out there. But sort of this melding of theory and experiment that, for example, defines the true genius of physics, I don't know if it doesn't happen in biology or it hasn't really happened yet. But, you know, for me, like looking at a genius, I would want to see someone who I would just sort of sit back and say, oh my God, I don't understand how they could do that. Right. And that sort of person I don't think really is around in biology right now, right? They're all sort of still human at some level.
Yeah. Final question here. We've ranged across quite a number of fields here. What are you optimistic about?
I'm very optimistic that we will actually come to understand more or less how our brain works. I think it'll be a tremendous thing. I am actually fairly optimistic about the future, although sometimes I wonder why. I think historically it's very common for people to feel like their era is the end of the world and that everything is falling apart. And people have been saying that things are falling apart and that the world is about to end for at least hundreds of years. I don't know about in the Middle Ages, but certainly from the 1700s on up, many people have been saying, oh, these new developments, everything is ending, you know, that's the end of moral culture. And I am optimistic that we will find ways not to blow ourselves up and not to pollute ourselves off the planet and to actually figure out sort of ways to continue. I think if you look at, for example, the status of, you know, the number of wars that are going on now, or the amount of starvation and the amount of disease, all of those things seem to be moving more or less to me in kind of the right direction on a long time scale. And so I kind of feel like it's going to be okay, or, you know, not great necessarily, but I think it will be okay in the long run.
Well, often science has actually been, it's this two-edged sword. I mean,
absolutely.
On one hand, it's the great benefactor and so on. But you mentioned going back, next year will be the 400th anniversary of a poem by John Donne, D-O-N-N-E, pronounced Donne, who wrote a poem in which he talked about the end of the world. He was actually supposed to be a memorial for somebody who just died. He was hired to write a poem about this, but the anatomy of the world he wrote was full of this great sense of how the science of the time, because he's writing in 1611, so this is post-Bacon, post-Harvey, around Gilbert, around about that period, he's thinking, God, this has changed. I mean, what's the world's going to...
Yes, the world's going to hell in a handbasket has been sort of a common feeling for a long time. And I feel like, you know, on one hand, I completely understand that, and our ability now more than ever to do ourselves in, right? That just keeps advancing. You know, at the same time, people have backed off the nuclear triggers a little bit.
Yeah.
We are getting better at curing diseases. We're getting better at figuring out what it takes for people to thrive as human beings. So, you know, I don't know how it's going to turn out, and I imagine it could all go very badly, but I feel reasonably optimistic. I think that there is a decent chance that my children's lives will at least be as good as my own. I really hope I'm not wrong about that.
Well, you had two, so you must be putting some kind of a bet out.
Yes, but we're only having two, so, you know. It's a hedged bet, I guess I would say.
All right, well, let's come back some other time and talk more about solving the brain. Lauren Frank, thank you so much.
Thank you, Roger.